Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of hope and the podcast of solutions. I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And today we are talking to Anthony Flynn, the founder and CEO of Inner City Helping Homeless. Anthony, it's great you could join us today.
Thanks for having us, Rory.
And Leisha Nealon, journalist and reporter with the Dublin Inquirer. Leisha, thanks also for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
If we look at the level of homelessness, people are coming back to this now in terms of actual the rise in homelessness. We've seen the numbers risen for the first time in July since the pandemic began. We have 2,600 children who are homeless, a third of all homeless are children. And of course, the context is the government has ended the ban on evictions and rent controls. We have warnings that we're going to see a further increase in homelessness in the coming months. So today we're going to discuss what's the reality on the ground, what should be done, and can we build in social and affordable housing to address not just homelessness, but the wider housing crisis and generation rent. We're going to discuss a number of issues around that. And just to remind our listeners, of course, you can, and we want you to support us to keep these podcasts going. If you find them interesting, or if you even find them useful as a sleep app, you can donate to Tortoise Shack, become a patron and donate to Tortoise Shack, please. Thank you. So first to Anthony. Anthony, you know, your organization is doing fabulous work in terms of responding, supporting those who are homeless, and also being, I think, quite a critical voice in terms of highlighting the scale and challenging the system as it exists, which is a really important role. But just in terms of working on the ground, how has homelessness changed over the last couple of months, and where is it at now?
I suppose we go back to pre-COVID and before COVID. We highlighted figures that at that time we would have saw about 80 or 90 people that would have been rough sleeping around the city, and they were in line with the official rough sleeper count at the time in December. Once COVID-19 hit, we saw an increase in the amount of people that were sleeping rough and an increase in the amount of people that were actually presenting on the street. And we also saw an increase in the amount of people that were accessing emergency accommodation in terms of singular adults. And, over the last number of weeks, we've seen two different reports, one from the department and the DRHE stating that there was 50 to 60 people sleeping rough on the streets. This week, we've seen the deputy chief executive issue a report to councillors and myself, and he's stating that 110 people are sleeping rough. And in the highest point over the last number of weeks, we've issued a report stating that there was 164 people sleeping rough. So you've got three very big differences within, obviously, government departments and the DRHE are lead in terms of producing those figures. We are always critical of those figures, but like we've seen increase after increase in terms of singular individuals that are accessing homeless services, and a lot of people. So the figures overall, through COVID-19, we saw a massive increase where there was the Irish Prison Service would have released prisoners without notifying the statutory bodies in terms of people being released from prison in order not to spread COVID-19. But what actually happened was they actually put these people straight into hostels, and they used the word decant, and that word alone is just for me. And it was a situation where decanting was the topic of the day, and let's, remove as many people from hostels. Yet we had such an influx of people that were coming from the Irish prison services, and that was basically overpopulating the hostel system. They took tourist hostels, and we had 80 people staying in one tourist hostel. It was absolutely it was crazy. And the whole narrative is that everything is okay and we're doing a fantastic job. And, not to get down on anybody, but Dr. Austin O'Carroll done a fabulous job in terms of prevention. And, anytime you had to pick up the phone to that man, he was there. But I don't believe the level of testing within those facilities was of a very high rate whatsoever. And even in family hubs and communal facilities that are used by, say, families and so forth, they were sharing toilets, they were sharing kitchens, the level of testing right across the board was very low, which to me indicated that that's why we weren't getting a high level of positive test results coming back. If we don't test, we don't get results. It's as simple as that. But what we kept doing, or the DRHE kept doing, was claiming victories, you know, victories that simply weren't won. It was a situation where they were claiming victories and you know, we might have won a battle through COVID-19, but we certainly didn't win the war. And there's now seen an increase, and we didn't see a decrease in the single adult population within homeless services. We saw a decrease in families. And like, to touch on that, the reason why we saw that is because those individuals are being put into 12-month license agreements. Airbnb, Stay City apartments. Stay City, for instance, wouldn't give us an apartment 2 years ago for a homeless family. I remember sitting in my office at 11:30 at night with Anne, where the family actually slept. If you remember, there was a major headline, the family actually slept on my office floor. There was nowhere for them to go. And I rang that company and asked them. They had advertised online a unit that was available. And because I indicated it was a homeless family, they wouldn't give us the units. They are now populated with homeless people. They're being signed off for cocooning. They're being signed off for emergency accommodation and so forth. And what's happened is a lot of those tourist apartments or Airbnb apartments or you know, they've been signed off now for 12-month license agreements with the council. So they bracketed 85 families, for instance, last month from the homeless figures, taking those 85 families out of homeless services, and they put them into these 12-month license agreements with absolutely no longevity around where that family is going to go, you know, when that 12-month license agreement is up. And the biggest problem for me is that they are going to want, you know, Stay City and any of these other organizations are going to want these apartments back as soon as we see an influx of tourists coming back into the country. And it's disingenuous, very, very disingenuous for the minister and for the DRHE to say that these people have been removed from homelessness, because they have no long-term plan in terms of their housing need, and removing them from that cohort of people that are homeless, putting them into a total different bracket, and then portraying to the public that the homeless crisis has gone away is disingenuous, to say the least. Now, although we did see an increase this month, the increase was warned. Everybody warned it. You know, Leisha warned it. I warned it. Others, you know, anybody that was advocating in the right manner warned that we were going to see, as soon as the eviction ban was lifted, we were going to see an increase in the amount of families. We've already seen probably up to a 35-38% increase in people coming to our door now with eviction letters and telling us. And our teams are working literally around the clock to try and put systems in place, firstly, so individuals don't get evicted, you know, or whatever we need to do in terms of courts and stuff like that. But that whole cohort is where we're going to see the increase. Straight away, the eviction ban. The eviction ban is going to see more and more people next month enter. It was a low number, and I'll be honest, it was lower than what I thought it was going to be when they released that figure last week. But I do think that over the next month, we're going to see a serious, serious increase in the amount of people that are coming through homeless services from evictions. The number of people in regard to single adult males in particular is always on the increase. And a report I have in front of me from Deputy Chief states that through the winter months, which we all know, we always see an increase through the winter months of. So we're counting 164 people sleeping rough now. I'm estimating we are going to be well over 200 mark come November. Which will have never been seen before. So, you know, the tsunami, the crisis, and whatever is on the way, big time.
Thanks, Anthony. Leisha, what's your sense? You've written a number of articles around this in terms of this, the homelessness statistics and how reliable they are, both in terms of rough sleepers, which aren't actually included in the homelessness statistics, and then the whole issue around this kind of, you know, own door accommodation, even if it's on a short term basis. You know, people are taking off the numbers. Firstly, you know, on the rough sleepers, do you know, what have you found from your research? And secondly, then wider, do you think you know, the homelessness statistics that are coming out monthly are reliable now, are useful in that sense?
With the rough sleeper thing, I think it's that when I went and asked, so the DRHE and the Department of Housing are attributing a number of 50 or 60 people on the streets each night. And they say that figure is collated by Dublin Simon Community. But when I asked Dublin Simon Community about that figure, they didn't wish to comment really in relation to that figure. They just said that an official rough sleeper count is usually done by the DRHE twice a year.
Yeah.
Now, the rough sleeper count wasn't done in April. I don't think the rough sleeper count from April would tell us anything now anyway. There's another one due in November. There's potential that we will be under increased restrictions again by November. So I suppose some people would argue that a rough sleeper count is needed now. Obviously, Anthony's organization, Inner City Helping Homeless, are on the streets every night. So they're recording the people that they're meeting anyway. And they have a location tracker that they can, so their figures are more verifiable probably. And they're meeting around 150 people a night on the street. It's definitely worrying to hear Anthony say that he thinks that's going to increase. But certainly I don't think anybody can really stand over the numbers coming from the department and DRHE at the moment because the Dublin Slamming community didn't verify them.
Yeah.
So that was the end of that, really.
Yeah.
There wasn't really anywhere else to go with it then. It was in terms of single people are increasingly becoming homeless. I think throughout COVID there's been an increase. There was supposed to have been 1,000 new beds opened at the start of COVID. It seems that in the singles hostel, there was a couple of hostels closed and Merchants Quay Night Cafe was closed. So it seems that whatever beds were opened only replaced really ones that had been closed. I'm not sure precisely what was wrong with the two hostels that had to be closed down during COVID. But there wasn't an overall much of an increase. I think there's an extra 60 beds maybe in the system for single people now compared with pre-COVID. So there was no big increase in beds for single people overall, even though tourist hostels were opened for single people. It's not clear if some of those hotels and stuff are being closed now again or not. I don't really know. Some people say they are. DRHE says that they're not closing any beds at the moment. But there definitely is a lack of beds at the moment. There's definitely people ringing up the free phone and they can't get a bed. So there's a shortage of beds at the moment.
And are you finding that as well, Anthony, that there actually is a shortage of beds, that people are ringing this number and not getting beds?
I suppose there's just a serious lack and breakdown of communication between central placement services and the organisations that are working. And what the DRHE seem to, keep putting a barrier up against is, the whole voluntary sector supporting them. And as Leisha had said, we're working with some of the best technology in regard to our tracker app and, the data information that's put into our app at night time in terms of how we break down. We break down by gender, male, female locations, the five teams that might be out. There's only two teams out. We blue in every location. But individuals that we're coming across every night will state, and just reading the report, I know you haven't got it in front of you, but the report that I received yesterday stated that there was 110 individuals are now sleeping rough, which is contrary to the report that they issued last week. So within the week, they've issued two different reports, one stating that 50 to 60 people were sleeping rough and one stating that 110 individuals were sleeping rough. And this states that the Dublin Simon Outreach Team provides services. The street outreach service reported to us that over the week of the 17th to the 23rd, 110 individuals slept rough. 87 of those, they're saying, are registered out of the 110. And the rest are not registered as homeless. Many individuals that are on the street won't register. They don't want to go through the whole format. They've had bad experiences in terms of whether it be homeless services, whether it be hostels or so forth, and tend maybe not to engage. And we call them entrenched homeless. These are people that, need a proper housing forced initiative around them instead of the laissez-faire approach that we have in terms of housing forced. But, people, they're not getting access to beds. And as Leisha said, Rory, it was a situation where, we were told 1,000 extra beds. We didn't see that. We ended up through COVID-19 spending upwards of €15,000 on emergency accommodation to put people into. We had to take over a building ourselves and pay for that building for people that may have had to cocoon, isolate, or so forth. So, and we got none of that kind of, we didn't get a refund from the DRHE anyway. But, when we heard 1,000 extra beds, we all jumped for joy and we all said, Jesus, this is going to be great. We won't have anybody. 1,000 extra beds put into the system for us is like winning the lottery. And then I'm on the, literally through COVID-19, we had set up a major operation here from the office and I was coordinating that. And I was expecting to see a major reduction in the amount of people that were sleeping rough. And then I wasn't seeing that reduction. I was seeing an increase in the amount of people that were sleeping rough. I was seeing an increase in the amount of people that were presenting. I was seeing an increase in tents that were cropping right the way up and down the canals and so forth and whatever. And that was physically identifiable to a lot of people. A lot of people were in
I've seen them myself as well. You see them around. There's more tents visible.
So there was no reduction. There was certainly no reduction. And over the last number of weeks, there's been an increase. And like, I'm not sure what the issue is about, you know, the denial around this. Like, we can all see there's a problem. And like, I've just found that over my time in particular, that, you know, when you come and you're like, I'm not here to cause you a problem. What I'm here to do is try to find a solution. And let's work together on finding that solution. But if you're not claiming Section 10 funding from the DOHE, and you're being critical of in any way, shape, or form of what they're doing, you know, you're ostracized and you're put to the outside, and they don't want to have to deal with you. And even, like Leisha will tell you, trying to get an answer to a question at times can be absolutely like pulling teeth with them. But we're in a situation where that number, I am worried. I do feel that over the coming months, we are going to see the highest ever recorded numbers. And we're just on this whole kind of roller coaster through COVID-19, where it kind of came off the roller coaster for a while. You know, it wasn't being spoken about because there was more important things people thought than homelessness, and COVID-19 is there. So, you know, I think we're going to see major issues in particular over the next 2 months.
And Leisha, then on that, in terms of that, like, you know, the situation that is putting people into homelessness, obviously one of the main ones, it has been evictions from the private rental sector. And, you know, it causes huge stress to families, individuals, children in particular. The whole process, the whole, you know, situation, circumstance of becoming homeless. But what are you seeing, or what are you coming across in terms of that now? The ban has been lifted. Are we seeing, or do you think we're likely to see, based on your work around an increase in evictions, or what do you think is happening around that?
Yeah, I think there is already quite a few evictions happening in the city. I know that housing activists have attended several evictions recently and formed protests outside, illegal evictions, and formed protests outside to try to get people back into their homes because they had been illegally evicted. And in some cases have been successful in doing that as well. So I misunderstood initially when the evictions ban was changed. I thought that anyone who'd lost income from COVID-19 was protected still. That's incorrect. You're only protected if the reason that the landlord gives for the eviction is rent arrears, and you also have lost income due to COVID-19. So basically, that means evictions are back on because the landlord can just cite a different reason.
Yes, exactly.
Another problem that housing activists had raised to me recently was that people don't understand sometimes if they've gotten, say somebody got 6 months notice back in February, they might think their 6 months is up now and they have to leave their home. That's not right, because the eviction notice was frozen during COVID and during the eviction ban. So that person who got 6 months in February, they still have like 4 months left to go to find a new place. They shouldn't actually be evicted now. So it's really complicated for people, and they think, oh, look, I got my 6 months notice in February, the eviction ban lifted, I have to leave my house. That's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, because it ran for a month, say, in March,
and then it was frozen.
Another month now since it's back in. So that person still has 4 months left to find a new place. But of course, once the eviction ban is lifted, you know, you're going to see over the next couple of months, there's going to be evictions, like, it's obvious. So, and then some of those people will fall through the cracks and become homeless. But with single people, you know, they're living quite precarious anyway in the city. A lot of them are sharing, things like that. I'm sure that a lot of people, the evictions ban just didn't really apply to them, and they've been becoming homeless throughout COVID, and that's why we're seeing this increase in single homelessness even during the evictions ban.
But it seems to me that, you know, if you look at it broadly, kind of from a political perspective, that it seemed, I still don't get why the government did, you know, rescind the ban so quickly, that they could have extended it for a further 6 months or even 8 months, and no one would really have lost, that it would have maintained it. Why do you think they did?
They said the Landlords Association, I mean, I just heard them on the radio like anybody else, but they were saying that they wanted to be able to do evictions in cases where they wanted to sell the property. They wanted to be able to do evictions in cases where they had antisocial behaviour. Although I think for serious antisocial behaviour, you could still evict anyway. So you just have to be able to evidence that and stuff like that. So there's obviously the landlords have their interest in being able to get access to their properties without the tenant in it. And that's the only reason I can see why they brought it back in. But there's no question that it's going to impact on homelessness.
And would you agree with that, Anthony, that this is the government bended to landlords, essentially, even though, you know, politically you would think it would be more popular to actually maintain the eviction ban in place?
Look, the narrative was always that they never wanted to do it. If you look at, you know, there's been advocation for a ban on evictions for a long time now. And the problem really is that they never wanted to put an eviction ban in place. At one stage, they said it was illegal. They took legal advice is what they told us before. And then, you know, and I think, I don't want to say like, was COVID-19 good? It was good because it saw some of, you know, what we were told could never happen actually happen. And when
it revealed
that we could have universal public health. It revealed that we could have, you know, the likes of eviction bans put in place, but they couldn't wait to lift it. They didn't want to put it in place from day one. That was evident, you know. And then when they did, they realised then that there was a cohort of people that are probably their pals and their buddies. And when we look at the amount of people that are landlords in the Dáil, for instance, you know, it's a situation where, you know, they never wanted to put it in. They lifted it quicker than they should have lifted it. And, you know, we saw just by the 3 months that it was in place, or I think it might have been four, but for that small period of time, if that did not identify that evictions are a big, big problem within the homeless system, you know, I don't know what is going to...
Yes, it did. It showed. It had an impact.
The month they lifted it, we saw an increase in the amount of people that were entering homeless. Now, whatever way they want to fudge the figures, I don't believe the figures. They're not worth the paper they're written on it, as far as I'm concerned at this stage. And that happened a long time ago under Owen Murphy's remit, when they start recalculating, moving people around from one cohort to another cohort. If your funding, if your housing is being paid, or your emergency accommodation being paid under Section 10 funding, you're homeless. We still don't count all of the people we should anyway, like our European counterparts. But the eviction ban as a whole, like I arrived up to eviction. I was asked to come up and support tenants in eviction. I couldn't believe how they were being treated. I absolutely was shell-shocked. And I was 5-6 hours late in terms of the crew that went in and removed that family and those individuals from that. Now, that was a dispute between a landlord and a bank. And, you know, it hadn't went to the High Court yet, although there was previous court orders on that landlord and whatever in regard to other properties. You know, it was a web. And when I went up, first of all, the reaction I got from the Gardaí after identifying myself to the Gardaí was totally out of order. I calmed things down. I spoke to those that were protesting, saying, look, the main issue here is the family. And the place was boarded up now when I arrived. I informed the guard, the sergeant in charge in Mountjoy, that I was going to remove the hoarding from the building and that I was going to put the family back in, that I had taken advice, and as far as I was concerned, my advice is correct. And he basically threatened me with arrest and said that I would be threatened for trespassing. And Gary Daly had come and asked the question, well, you know, he told us to go back to court. So we were never in court. You know, the tenants were never in court. The tenants never got a... And it's only when you get into that legal mind frame of, you know, when things are going on like that and it's a highly volatile situation and you've got 9 people that have been thrown out on the road with all their belongings. My main concern was where they were going to sleep at that night because it was getting late. But then I was getting kind of pissed off with the fact that the Gardaí are dictating here and telling me what... And I knew it's not that I was wrong or right. It was the tenants and it was the paperwork was out of order and everything else. That there was no paperwork anyway. But like, we went back the next day and we put them into that property. You know, and I think that was a big, big victory because I remember speaking to the chief superintendent afterwards. There was another eviction that took place closely after that. And the same Gardaí actually arrived and refused to intervene because they said that it was a civil matter. You know, and they got a bit of lackery for that because, you know, it wasn't a civil matter here last week, guys. You went in and you swore. And now I have said to the chief superintendent, the Gardaí were complicit in an illegal eviction. They assisted in an illegal eviction. There's videos of a Gardaí telling, you know, the individuals of that property that they had to leave the property, no right to be on the property. And that's not the guard's job. And that's very, very worrying, Rory, when it comes to what might happen in the future. And we should have saw, you know, the commissioner come in when Frederick Street happened previously. and that issue, that whole issue around Frederick Street and the evictions that happened in Frederick Street. And that was kind of a different story. But again, the Garda Commissioner should have kind of drawn down then and said, look, the Garda are here to keep the peace. They're not here to assist in illegal evictions. And that's what happened in Berkeley Road. And the fear is that that's going to happen again.
Leisha, what's your sense? Is the whole issue of evictions, and, you know, because it doesn't just affect those, you know, facing immediate threat of homelessness, it faces, you know, many people who are just renting and have to move, you know, they're not, you know, they have the financial capacity to move somewhere else, but it is a huge impact on, you know, everyone who's renting, and particularly, you know, that affects the younger generations and those who are on lower income. But this sense of that there is a need to change the law around this, that, you know, we do actually need a right to housing, a right to a home, so that when, you know, the treatment of these evictions, that the starting point for guards or for, you know, for the law, for the courts, is that actually this is a person's home first. Do you think that we need to talk more about that?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on. Like there's evictions themselves in general, and then there's the illegal evictions. I mean, the number of illegal evictions that we're getting reported at the moment is very strange. It appears that some landlords don't actually know the laws that exist. There are comprehensive tenants' rights in place in general. Yeah. But it seems that some landlords don't know what the rules are. I heard of one case recently where the family had gone back to their country of origin for personal reasons, and then they returned and the landlord had changed the locks on them and thought that he could do that. And I mean, so there's the illegal evictions, which is one whole issue, I suppose. And then I guess at the moment with COVID and with the way things are, there's just the issue of evictions in general. There are no tourist hostels open at the moment. There are, you know, most share houses don't want new people coming in. So where do people go if they're evicted now? It's not necessarily going to be easy to just rent another property. I mean, we have to see what happens, I suppose, with student housing now this month. It'll be interesting to see if there's a surplus of accommodation there and how that will be handled. Like, it seems to me that should remain as student housing and that the providers should drop the prices so that students can afford it. And then that might free up some family homes if there is a surplus there, with the numbers of international students coming in being down. At the moment, it's too pricey. Most Irish students can't afford it. It'd be great to see that kept as student housing, which it was planning approved for and built for. And then that would probably free up a lot of family homes that are currently, you know, students just renting rooms for 400 or 500 a month.
Lisa, there's multiple applications gone in that I've seen anyway, in particular around the Point Village and stuff like that, that would have been primarily the applications for Beale's War student accommodation, for purpose-built student accommodation, and that, you know, they weren't for tourist lets. I've seen about 5 or 6 applications that have looked to change their planning permission from student accommodation to holiday lets and to longer term residential lets. So a lot of those student providers as well have actually approached the council, and I've had multiple approaches, and I've had 2 anyway, from providers looking to see would we take over their buildings, because they know they're not going to be in a position to rent those out once the students are working from home. Like, students are running amok saying, you know, we're paying 3,000 in fees and we're going to be working from home, paying our own rent or paying our own Wi-Fi and everything else that's going to happen at home, and yet these units are going to lie empty. But I can see a major shift now towards trying to put those units into place. And a lot of units as well, Rory, or B&Bs, have got letters off the council over the last week stating that they won't be using them anymore, that they're not going to use the emergency accommodation units anymore. So I think if the student accommodation crashes, there's going to be serious.
No, you can see it, Alicia, you're right to raise it, because you can see it, like there's more units, you know, it was passing Ballymun there the other day, there's a huge student unit's been built up there. But what comes to mind straight away is kind of the similar issue to what you said about the staycation apartment lets being used on a temporary basis. Not only is it just a temporary issue, the design of student units are not appropriate for, you know, people to live. They're not appropriate housing. And it's kind of the way in which we have allowed, you know, our buildings are, you know, it's all speculative development, you know, it's on what's going to make profit rather than actually building people's homes. And I think that would bring us along to the question of, you know, solutions, and the fact that we have huge public land banks sitting there, huge amounts of state land, And yet still, you know, the number of social housing units, despite, you know, the government saying the official figures are that they provided 28,000 social housing solutions last year, but the overwhelming majority of those were from the private rental sector and HAP, and only 4,000 were actually built, actually new social housing. We have this major issue that we're not building enough social and affordable housing, not just to address homelessness, but also the wider needs of people on low and average incomes. And this is where kind of that whole cost rental idea comes in, which brings us to O'Devany Gardens and the very, very, I suppose, controversial and long-standing issue, you know, a community that was built, was all social housing community. I remember being up there decades ago with the community prior to the whole public-private partnership regeneration, a very strong community that was decimated essentially by that approach.
Yeah.
Where, Leisha, you've been researching this. Where is O'Devany at right now in terms of the plans?
I mean, where do you start? Obviously, you can see what's happening. You're both laughing there as soon as you mentioned it. I don't know if anyone will ever. I mean, it's a saga. You could write you could write a series of novels.
All his next book.
So the deal is done for the redevelopment. Okay, that seems to be decided.
Yeah.
Contracts are signed with Bartra. We're expecting planning permission from Bartra. I think it's supposed to be this month. Although we've been saying that for a while, but I guess it has been COVID or whatever. So there is a number of social homes under construction on a separate part of the site, and they're making good progress. There is the issue of a cost rental scheme for O'Devany Garden. So yeah. The deal that was done with Bartra allows for a certain number of social homes, a certain number of homes to be sold affordably. And then Bartra is building private, I think 400 and something homes they're building as private homes. I don't have the figures in front of me now, but...
Yeah, but they will sell themselves on the market.
Yes, but they'll sell themselves on the market. But a deal was done last December to purchase some of those market price homes for a cost rental scheme. But the problem with that is that Bartra is overestimating the value of private homes on the site. I looked at Smithfield Square in comparison, and I mean, people know, I guess everybody in Dublin knows where Smithfield Square is. It's the old Castle Market. It's walking distance to Henry Street. It's got, you know, genuine pubs that have been there for 300 years. It has a cinema, it has a gym. It's a very desirable location.
The local estate agents will be on to you to offer you a job if that's
I mean, I live in Dublin 7 myself. Like, I'd love to buy an apartment in Smithfield Square because I can't afford one, right? But it's an apartment in Smithfield Square. Before COVID, when I was doing this story back in December, you know, you're talking about 320,000, maybe up to 350,000. You get a balcony, you get 2 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. They're a decent size and all the rest of it. And you get a car parking space.
Yeah.
Bartra's saying that it's market homes are going to be worth 450,000 on average between 1 and 2 beds. That means it's a 2-bed, it must be estimated to be worth about 470,000. So that's about 120,000 euros more than Smithfield Square.
Yeah.
And when I asked Dublin City Council, they couldn't tell me whether or not those had parking.
Could you explain?
Now, I don't know if that has changed. But parking is quite interesting because parking, as you know, also drives up the cost of building.
Yeah.
The fact that they didn't know whether or not they had parking meant that they hadn't really got down
and dirty. Anything.
They hadn't really done due diligence on what the costs were to Bartra of actually building these units either. So the parking thing kind of threw up a lot of questions as well. We're told that these apartments are going to be really, really high spec. The councillors have voted in favour of the deal are really adamant they're going to be all singing, all dancing, really, really high spec. But at the same time, you know, Dublin City Council couldn't tell me if they had parking.
Yeah. So I just want to explain to people, because not everybody knows what cost rental is.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Of course, the cost rental is an affordable rental scheme. So the idea of cost rental is that your rent kind of covers the mortgage and the running costs of the apartment.
Yeah.
It's very popular in Austria. It's very popular in other European countries. The government basically builds housing and renters rent the homes and they cover the costs, whatever the mortgage is on the property. Obviously, governments can borrow at lower interest rates. So the mortgage, the repayments should be quite low. if you build for a reasonable amount.
Yeah.
But
and the point being that this is not like social, this in terms of the difference with social housing, with cost rental, is the cost rental is available to basically people on average incomes and...
Yes. Cost rental would be for the people who maybe don't qualify for social housing, but can't afford to buy.
Yeah.
So there would be a lot of people, obviously, of all ages in Dublin who are in that bracket. Maybe they don't have a deposit, maybe their salary doesn't allow it, or they're self-employed, or, you know, all kinds of people who are stuck renting and kind of can't get on the property ladder. It would be fantastic to have an affordable rent scheme, because it might allow some people as well to save. If their rent was a bit less, they might be able to save that money and then eventually buy. Otherwise, yeah. People can be perfectly happy, like, living out in public housing, certainly in Vienna and places like that. It's really good, so you don't need to buy. You're very happy to live there all your life, and because your rent is fixed at a reasonable rate, and because it's secure and things like that, so you don't have to worry. It's a good one. It's a good job from the point of view of the government as well, because it should cover its own costs. So this shouldn't be a cost to the taxpayer, because you build it on public land and you charge the rent as the amount that covers the loan to build the home and the maintenance costs. So it's not really a cost to the exchequer in that sense. There is a problem if you buy the house too expensive, though, or if you buy the apartment too expensive, then the cost rental won't be affordable.
So this is what you're pointing out in relation to the issue is with O'Devney Gardens, that you've been bought from Bartra.
I mean, it could be argued that they're not going to be affordable, because it's just too high a price to pay. We don't know exactly what the deal is with Bartra, but it's probably close enough to their version of market rate, which I would argue is a good 120 grand above the actual market rate in Dublin 7. But, you know, when Bartra are looking for the homes, it's just very, very expensive. So it's very hard to see how that would work for a cost rental scheme. Even where the council is building directly, there are concerns that the rents won't be affordable. So certainly if you're going to pay way over the odds for the housing, then no, it won't work. It won't be affordable. It doesn't make sense. There's two-bedroom apartments with balconies in Dublin 7 for sale at the moment for less than 300,000. So it's hard to see why you'd pay 450 square, to be honest.
Yeah. Anthony, do you have any idea as councillor, have you been informed of what the rent is likely to be in O'Devney Gardens under the affordable rental scheme?
So they can't confirm, as Lisa said, they can't confirm anything. It's like the Motley Crew. They literally just haven't got a clue what's going on. And just this week we saw that they've looked to increase the amount of homes that are on the land by 100 private homes to be added in addition to what would have been approved by councillors. Obviously, I didn't approve it, but the Dublin Agreement councillors did. And Bartra have come back. They had already asked for 3-month extension. Alicia, this would be news to you, because I only got it this week. They already got a 3-month extension on their planning permission on the ground, and they've actually come back now. So they come back looking for another 3 months planning permission. So we won't get to see the actual plans until December 7th on what's going to go on it. But those plans are going to be inclusive of an additional 100 private homes that were never on the plans in the first place. So basically what we would have been arguing from day one was obviously the cost rental. You know, what was going to be put on the land in terms of public housing or affordable housing for individuals that were from the area, or people that have moved away from the area and wanted to move back in. You know, obviously the level of social homes going onto the land for the deal that Bartra had done was very, very bad. Like, you know, the best deal that the council were getting was to be able to buy back the units, you know, the units at an increased or inflated cost, which was absolutely madness. And even for that cost rental model to want to, it would mean that grants would have to come from the Department of Housing in order to make them affordable anyway, shape or form. So like, the plan overall to me is just ludicrous. But what's, you know, seriously, seriously worrying now is that they've come back for an extended period, looking for extended time on the planning permission, which means that we've seen nothing. We've seen nothing. I don't believe that what we saw in terms of what the Dublin Agreement agreed to is even going to be anywhere near what's going to be put in front of us for the planning permission. And with the additional 100 houses the information I have is stating that those additional 100 houses that are being added to, so where are they getting the land on the land to put an additional 100 houses? Whereas this was all planned. This was all, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing. Bartra are there for one reason, that's to make money. That's why they call it Bartra Capital. You know, to come back with this 100 extra houses coming onto this land that was never there before and all for private sale by Bartra, we're not getting, in terms of council or the community or the taxpayers, getting nothing back out of this. We sold off the Crown Jewels, and they sold us up to Liffey with it, basically.
And then something that I've you know highlighted before and written about, like the public private partnerships in that were developed first on Devonny Gardens, like it's such a tragedy. If you know, it would be a farce if it wasn't such a tragedy. You know that this community, like St Michael's Estate and other communities, public land that had been planned in the previous boom of up to 2008. To develop as public-private partnerships collapsed when the developers decided it was no longer profitable. And of course, in the current, you know, we pointed out and critiqued that part of the fundamental flaw with these public-private partnerships is you're dependent on whether the developer, the investor, deems it profitable to build or not.
Exactly.
And the whole plan is built around that. And of course, now we're in this situation where I'm sure Bartra are looking at it and going, you know, yes, they're going to need an additional 100 private units, but as you say, the extending of the planning permission means, you know, will they even deem it viable at some point? They'll turn around 6 months ago, do you know what, you know, there's no sign of this property market increasing.
Rory, that's the biggest issue, and something that I had said, and look, I ripped up the agreement in the chamber, you know, there you go, guys, this is not worth the paper it's written on. And the reason why is because there's no agreement. There's no actual contract between the council and Bartra in terms of what. There's promises. There's a wish list. There's, you know, and we know from previous experience in any kind of project like this or anything that has got anything to do with the government, all right, that it does not work. The public always ends up getting sold out. You know, and the community in particular here are not going to get value for our money in terms of what's going to be given back in regard to community gain. And the biggest issue is what was for me at the time that it wasn't a contract. It was a wish list and an agreement and a shake, like, you know, we shake hands on this and we'll agree to it. And already now, before the planning permission is even lodged, we saw that agreement has been changed and that Bartra are going to come back with 100 private homes on that land wasn't in the agreement of force base. So by the time, as you said, it does go to planning permission and by the time they actually get built, what else is going to change?
To finish up on a positive note, on a hopeful note, there is actually social housing been built, as you mentioned, Leisha, here on O'Devony. And of course, who has it been built by? It's been built by the council, like obviously, you know, tender and builders, but they are actually the ones leading on it. Do you know, have you any update in terms of the cost rental, the building of cost rental in St. Michael's Estate? You know, are we any further on that? Or, you know, because the figures, while they're nowhere near what's needed, there is an increase in building of social housing happening.
Go ahead, sorry. I don't know if there is an increase of social and affordable housing being built. I mean, the DCC build figures are low. I mean, you can go on and look at them on the website. The direct build and the approved housing body build, they're still very low. Has construction started yet in St. Michael's? I don't think so, Anthony, has it?
No, it hasn't, no.
No. There is some affordable rental housing being built in Dunleary, right down county. That has begun. Or at least planning is in. Planning is in for Enniskerry. For Shangana. Planning is in for Shangana. And that's in Dunleary, right down county, and that will go ahead. The only concern there is that they've put in for they have put in the planning application under the built rent regulations, which is lower specification than the permanent family homes that you would buy. So unfortunately the social and affordable housing that's going in Shangana is it's under those regulations, and that can allow for smaller apartment sizes. The built rent regulations also allows for there not to be balconies on some of the houses and things like that. So there are some concerns, and even it was actually a Fine Gael councillor that raised it with me, that he was very concerned about the planning application that went in for Shangana.
That's recently enough, because I actually hadn't heard that. That's a very significant change that a public body would be putting in application to build affordable rental housing under the build to rent, as you say, which is a much lower guideline.
Lower spec. Yeah. So it was a big concern. It's a big concern there that's what they're doing. And then the concern is, are they going to do that? Because obviously the idea of public housing is that you can live in it for a long time and that it is your permanent family home and that you don't have to move on from it. So, you know, in terms of getting better homes and security for renters and things like that, it's not good.
Yeah, but in terms of building a home for people that they can live, that they have enough space, that they can, you know, have a family, that they can have a partner, that people can, you know, have the space to actually live, it seems, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And have a balcony to put a clothes horse outside and have a, you know, so that the kids can get fresh air, so that, you know, so that you can have a cat. I mean, you know, so many renters can't have pets and things like that. It's really quite extreme.
Yeah, yeah. Anthony, back to that, you didn't really come back to me. are we building social housing in Dublin?
No, I don't think we're building at any extreme level. I think that, like, St. Michael's Estate still, you know, they're still talking. You know, the council haven't got a plan in terms of, you know, affordable housing or anything along that. Like, there's nothing written in stone there to say that this is what way we're going to move forward in regard to affordable housing model in Dublin. And then, like, oh, definitely, yeah, it's great to see that the social housing is being built there, but, you know, or the initial, that had begun already. But
yes.
The fact is that's going to be, you know, what we're doing is we're ostracizing a community there, you know. We put them over there, and that little bit of land over there, and build all the social housing over there. Yeah, exactly. And you know, although it is great to see, and I do believe what you said, you know, positive note, you know, I'm happy to see any you know, social or affordable housing being built on public land, and that's what we should be doing. What I'm not happy about is what we have to sell in order to get that small margin of social or affordable housing. And the next Old Ebony Gardens, Rory, is going to be the Ballymore site in the north inner city, where we're selling off CIE lands, we're selling off council lands. The whole of the north, like, literally facing my office here at Conley Station, is going to be sold right the way down the boundary wall, all the way back up to Seville Place, all the way back onto Amien Street again, and into the Conley Quarter, as it's being called. And again, we're getting no social housing. We're getting the opportunity to buy back some of the units at market rate after paying 25 years rent on those apartments. So the apartments, they give us, we have to pay rent for 25 years. After we finish paying the rent for 25 years, then we will get the opportunity to buy them at full market rate. So, you know, we're seeing another kind of Old Ebony already kicking off down here.
Because like, you can see on Richmond Road, for example, in Drumcondra, there was a new, you know, social housing unit's been built. I think they're by Respond.
Yeah,
and, you know, they're really very attractive. You know, they seem to be quite high quality.
Well, Rory, the dependency on the voluntary housing bodies in order to build public housing has absolutely soared through the roof over the last number of years. You know, and I'm not against voluntary housing bodies. You know, I'm involved in some. So, you know, but that the council's over dependency on voluntary housing bodies to build public housing is a serious, serious issue. And when we look at what happened up there, sorry, that Leisha done off Berkeley Street by a voluntary housing body that actually moved students in and put old folks out, evicted old folks from the voluntary housing body, moved students in and charged the market rate, had their own family living in. You know, we can't, and I'm not tarring everybody with the one brush here, but we need the council to be building. We can't have, we've more charities and voluntary housing bodies in this country now, you know, than any other country, I believe. It's absolutely unbelievable how we're shirking our responsibility from government, the council, the voluntary housing bodies and charities. It's not going to work, and it's not going to be sustainable in the future.
But the point being, though, that the council can build, that's my point about highlighting, even if it's small numbers, they are building, which shows they can build. And if they wanted to, they would not have
to do
these Old Ebony Garden projects, which are completely...
It's interesting, though, Rory, in fact, that, you know, the housing manager in Dublin City Council is saying that it costs him around €350,000 to build a unit on the land that the council owns, and considering that they don't have to pay taxes. So that's very pricey. You know, if you were given €350,000 and you already own the land, what kind of house would
Ashton
you build?
Hills' contractor.
But, like, but you have to kind of question some of this stuff. And
Department of Housing figure says they can build public housing, social housing for 200,000 per unit.
Yes, and certainly in Dunleary Rathdown County, which is also an urban part of Dublin, they appear to be able to build for a lot cheaper than Dublin City Council. So you do have to query, is there an issue with quantity surveyors in Dublin City Council? Or where does the issue lie? Why is it 200,000 in all the other local authorities like Cork City, like Dunleary Rathdown? It's maybe 250, 280 for an apartment, two-bed apartment in Dunleary Rathdown County. Why does it jump up by 100 grand when it's DCC?
And the point that O'Coolan are building them Dublin City Council land for less than 320,000.
Yeah, I mean, arguably you could say, why don't they just give it all to O'Coolan and let them develop it, so if they really can't do it for less? I mean, to be honest, I think there's probably a few builders around Ireland laughing about this stuff at this stage, like.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anthony, why aren't they, why are they saying so expensive in Dublin?
Again, everything is more expensive with Dublin City Council for some reason. We seem to be coming back to the same contractors. We seem to be giving the same people the contracts on, you know, and we've been proven to be burnt time after time after time at Dublin City Council. It's the same in homeless services, the private emergency accommodation operators. Leisha will tell you, we had one. We ran the numbers over the last number of weeks in regard to hostels, and we're paying just over 3,000 per month per person to stay in a room of 10 people. All right. So if that doesn't tell you there's something wrong, where we're paying up to 30 grand for 10 people to stay in a room per month, not per year. It's absolutely ludicrous. We have
that's creating a monster, like, in the way that if you can put five guys in a room and you get 3 grand each of them, you're getting 15 grand for a room. That's really going to create problems because.
And nobody took up on that, Leisha, Rory. Like, you know, we've been, for 2 years, we put these figures out where we broke it down to each individual unit in terms of what the profit is on these emergency accommodation units. And it's the same in the building. What we haven't got is a proper due diligence, a proper cost analysis in regards to, you know, tenders and stuff like that we're doing. Sure, even when we get a void back, when we get an empty unit back, it's taken up to 8 months before somebody even goes in and looks at that unit to do a surveillance on it. And then when we do get it, it's costing us, you know, the manager is telling us it's costing up to 60 grand per unit to refit units. I've seen them taking brand new kitchens out of some of these units, brand new bathrooms out of them, and putting, you know, so the due diligence and the actual surveying on it is just absolutely ridiculous. And in terms of the overall building, everything is inflated with Dublin City Council because, again, builders are making money. It's who pat in the back politics. It's who we can look after. I can guarantee you, if you chase the money, you'll chase it all the way back up to housing in Dublin City Council. And you will do so by their mates that are the builders or someone's friend that's the builder. And look, that's the way this country
goes. You might find a few of them at a hotel in Clifton as well.
Well, I don't know. I wasn't there anyway. That's all I know. I was in Farnham.
I'm very surprised you didn't get an invite.
For some reason, they're not talking to me, Rory. I don't know why, you know. They don't like me. I don't know what I've done on them, you know, that I don't get that. But sure, look, I went to Farnham and had a game of golf.
You're also cranky. That's the problem.
That's what it is, yeah, cranky.
I think, Rory, it is interesting. And I think the privatisation of homeless services is the one to watch. That's going to be a big story that's going to unfold over the next 6 months or a year. You're putting people with vulnerabilities, mental health, you know, people coming out of the care system, very, very vulnerable people. And you're putting them into hostels with absolutely no support, to the extent that a social worker in a hospital can't even ring the hostel staff because the hostel staff don't have a file, they don't have a support plan, they don't know who these guys are. So it's going to going to explode somewhere along the line. The system is not sustainable.
Yeah, we've seen it in direct provision. You know, we've seen this privatization model and absolutely what it does. So listen, Leisha, Anthony, thanks so much for joining us on Reboot Republic today. That was a really good conversation. I tried to drag a bit of hope out of you, but that's it. But listen, support Anthony Flynn. Don't support Anthony Flynn. Support the Inner City Helping Homeless and the great work that they do despite Anthony. And of course, the Dublin Inquirer as well, doing great work as well, highlighting these issues and supporting Leisha to keep asking the hard questions. And if you have any money left after that, you can donate to us, tortoiseshack.ie, support us. Anthony, Leisha, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rory.
Thank you very much, Rory.